Sterling deserves justice, and the family is hopeful that our governmental officials continue conducting a transparent, timely, and thorough investigation in pursuing justice for Terrence Sterling.
War is a racket. We know it's a racket. We know it's a business. All these bases are profit centers. They have nothing to do with national security whatsoever. The only security they have to do with is major CEO multi-million dollar salaries.
If you look around, you see all these buildings being put up, and you also see all these homeless people and tents and things of that nature. It just doesn't make any sense for the government to keep wanting to take people's property, take people's homes.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum. Well, on today's show, activists are speaking out about a largely unreported fatal shooting by D.C. police of an unarmed black man, Terrence Sterling, right here in the city. We'll speak to April Goggins, core organizer for Black Lives Matter, D.C., and anti-war activists from around the nation and world gathered here this week for the No War 2016 conference held at American University. All that is coming up, but first our headlines. The family of Terrence Sterling, who was shot and killed by D.C. police on September 11th, held a press conference on Thursday. Through their attorney, Jason Downs, they said that recently released body cam footage of the incident raises more questions than it answers.
The unreleased portion of the body camera footage shows a police union representative arriving on the scene to protect Officer Traynor. And the family and the community want to know, who did these officers call first? Did they call an ambulance to protect an innocent civilian, or did they call a police union representative to help Officer Traynor get his story straight? Did Officer Traynor's partner activate his body camera? What about the Homeland Security camera at 3rd and M Streets? Is there any satellite footage? Because we know that national security requires our nation's capital to be fully protected at all times, especially on September the 11th.
More about Terrence Sterling after headlines. Also this week, residents of the Berry Farms housing complex were in D.C. court appealing a lower court ruling that would allow demolition of the low-income homes in Southeast D.C. The case involving Berry Farms, built on land purchased by African Americans just freed from slavery, is seen by residents and activists as emblematic of issues of gentrification, the lack of affordable housing, wealth inequality, and homelessness. Paulette Matthews, a resident of Berry Farms, told WPFW's Taking Action that the survival of lifelong D.C. residents is on the line.
The judicial system, this housing issue, all of this is just madness. We're here on earth fighting for everything. It's almost like it's the rich against the poor, the haves and the have-nots, God, good or evil, or the devil. And it's like always a constant fight for whatever to be here. But the point is that I'm a D.C. resident. I shouldn't be forced out of the District of Columbia, period, whether it be Berry Farms or anywhere. I should be able to live in Northeast, Northwest, Southeast, Southwest. The rent shouldn't be that outrageous that I can't afford to stay there. There are some people out here now who have good jobs. 4 and 5 and 6 people are still living within their household just to be able to maintain.
Yes.
So my thing is, we need to get a grip on everything, because if it's not affecting you at the present time, it can affect someone in your family. If you look around, you see all these buildings being put up, and you also see all these homeless people and tents and things of that nature. It just doesn't make any sense for the government to keep wanting to take people's property, take people's homes, take advantage of the elderly. It just doesn't make any sense. And we have to stop this somewhere. This issue is not just about Brave Farms. It's about stuff that's happening nationwide.
More than 200 families are still living at Berry Farms. The Court of Appeals is expected to make its decision in the coming weeks. Also in the D.C. Court of Appeals, residents supporting the preservation of historic McMillan Park in Northwest D.C. argued their case against the demolition of the park and a developer plan to construct high-density downtown-style office space and luxury housing. Chris Otten, one of the community activists at the courthouse, said he was encouraged by the fact that one of the judges mentioned gentrification as a land use impact. The prison industrial complex was the focus of two national actions this week. Color of Change, the ACLU, and Mijente were among the organizations that rallied Wednesday and delivered petitions with more than 250,000 signatures to the Department of Homeland Security, urging the department to end its business relationship with private prisons. Homeland Security is the largest client of private prisons in the country. Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change, addressed the crowd.
DHS is the biggest revenue resource for private prisons and has an opportunity to shift the tide on this unconscionable practice of making money off of what amounts to modern-day slavery. That's why we are calling on DHS to end its contracts with private prison companies. Taxpayer dollars should not be used to reward those who traffic in human misery.
And at Plymouth Congregational Church, a conference on mass incarceration was part of a national effort by the United Church of Christ. Chantel James has more.
Community members met at Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ on Sunday, September 24th, for solutions-oriented talk on mass incarceration. Speakers included Ajoa Aitoro, Director of the Racial Disparities and Criminal Justice Project, Stuart Anderson, Founder and Director of Family and Friends of Incarcerated People, and Larry Watson, Director of Reunion. Several of the speakers shared their own experiences as incarcerated people and friends and family of incarcerated people, bringing much-needed perspective. After the speakers held forth, there was a breakout session for ways that we as a community can help end mass incarceration. Ajoa Aitoro provides some historical context for the current epidemic.
This is not something that started in the 80s or the 90s. This is something that started immediately after the so-called emancipation. And what happened, many of you know, and many may not know, that starting after the emancipation and reconstruction, there would develop, particularly in the South, convict leasing system. And that was through the black holes, and black men and women were targeted using the black holes, you know, these false sense, you know, these false laws or false statements that they're just loitering, so that they were, you know, they were arrested for offenses that were really created to only target black men and black women. Black men were more specifically targeted, but black women were also targeted, and they were put in prison, and they were served as, again, free labor for the state and private industry. In many ways, the research on convict leasing system suggests that the treatment of those who were caught up in it, black men and to some extent black women, was even worse in many ways than slavery, because of the fact that there was no investment in that body. So it was no need to keep them healthy. There was no need to provide any minimal sustenance of any kind. So when they die, they just arrested another black man or another black woman, and it was replaced. But that's really the beginning of what we call today mass incarceration, and I call the targeting of black bodies by the criminal punishment system.
For more information on how you can help stop the epidemic of mass incarceration, visit Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ's website at www.plymouth-ucc.org. For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
Finally, in culture and media, the new National Museum of African American History and Culture is drawing thousands of visitors during its opening week. Time passes are actually all gone for the rest of this year. You can hear my resistance-minded tour of the museum, which we broadcast during last week's show, that is the September 23rd show, on our show website, onthegroundshow.org. Also, the poet, critic, and scholar Sterling Brown was honored at a symposium held at the Busboys and Poets Brooklyn location. Attorney and civil rights veteran Timothy Jenkins was among those who said that the longtime Howard University professor who joined the ancestors in 1989 would be supportive of today's students in the movement for Black lives, just as he supported his students who were part of the 1960s Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC.
It is to be forgiven if sand gets in the voice and lemon juice in the eyes of old boys like me when we're called upon to remember our beloved professor. For it can be said of him, as it was said of Ma Rainey, he just gets hold of us that way. He did not rhapsodize or romanticize about race, despite its centrality to his work. He simply told it like it was, sometimes with humor, sometimes with horror. He dealt with lots of unpretty things along the way. Murder, rape, lynchings, floods, genocide, arson, and countless obstructions of justice. These were things sometimes too terrible to hit with straight licks, except through the crooked sticks of humor, satire, and oblique directness in direction of folk literature. But in all of this, he brought an understanding to the distorted subject of the matter of race, reminiscent of the ancient Egyptian moral principles of Ma'at, rectitude, reciprocity, dignity, and balance.
The program on Sterling Brown was organized by the Premier Community Development Corporation as part of an effort to honor Black artists and historic figures with roots in Brooklyn and other neighborhoods of Ward 5 in D.C. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, more on the fatal police shooting of Terrence Sterling. Stay with us. I have on the line April Goggins, a core organizer for Black Lives Matter DC. Good morning, April.
Good morning.
So why don't we start with explaining, what happened with Terrence Sterling? A lot of people in the area still do not understand or know about his case. There's been a lot more coverage of the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott in Charlotte and Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa. But tell us about Terrence Sterling right here in D.C.
Right. So on September 11th of this year, Terrence Sterling was shot by an MPD officer on the corner of 3rd Street and M Street Northwest. According to the first statement made by the acting or interim chief of police, Newsham, they said that Terrence was driving erratically and that these two officers got that call and thought he fit the description and pursued him and then said that he intentionally rammed their vehicle. They feared for their lives and shot him. But immediately there were witnesses who speak to the exact opposite of that happening. And so what we also found out shortly, even the day after, was that that officer failed to turn on his body camera until after Terrence had been shot and killed. Right. And so the next day, Muriel Bowser, I guess, takes a step and determines that all officers need to she changed the policy, determining that all officers needed to check in with dispatch, and dispatch would make sure that they turned on their body cameras each time that they are called to a job or they're on duty. And after that, we find out that it starts to look like these things, that the police story is not adding up to what witnesses say, as well as it's not matching up between the statements that are being given. The mayor's office, as well as MPD, decided to withhold the officer's information, citing that they were afraid that it would put him in undue danger. But
I know that he had a big action this week,
right?
And
right.
There was a rally like
pre-dawn, kind of marking the time that Terrence Sterling was shot and killed, and it stretched into the rush hour. And I think you've had some steps taken by the city since then.
Right. So, you know, it actually all started with us having people on Twitter call in to Mayor Bowser's office and demanding that she release the information. And the next day we actually a friend of Terrence, Stephen Douglas, had a vigil on Monday that started at 4:19, which is approximately the time that Terrence was killed. During that time, we had a vigil. We spoke about Terrence, about police brutality, especially with regard to MPD. And then shortly after, we took that intersection and held up traffic probably for a good half an hour in protest of what had happened and demanding answers. The next day, there was also a lunchtime protest in March to police headquarters. And so our pressure has definitely pushed things forward in this, which is actually a really good sign, because often these murders in D.C. by police go without any kind of notice amongst residents of the district. And so it really shows how important it is for us to be just as outraged as folks in Charlotte or Tulsa or Ferguson are, and that it's happening right here in D.C.
Right. Right. Now, I know I saw a few posts, I guess, before this week from you, kind of maybe showing a little frustration that people weren't kind of rallying around this case. Do you think that, you know, based on your years now of organizing, that D.C. folks need a little extra push, or is there apathy, or people tend not to want to be involved? What do you think it is in terms of D.C. and getting people out and to show concern?
Right. I think there's a large number of factors. The first, unfortunately, is because there wasn't a video. The videos of the actual of black folks actually being shot and dying for reasons that, you know, we can look deeper into tend to make these things go viral a lot faster. I think it's that immediate visceral reaction. I also think right. that it's something that has been normalized in D.C. I mean, if people look at the amount of people that are actually shot and killed by MPD each year, and remember that we have like 30 police departments in D.C., and so each one of them has their record of shooting people and fatally shooting people each year. It's not that it doesn't happen here, but even some of the brutality in black neighborhoods here, but it feels a little bit normalized. But I will say that when folks do learn about it, they are just as outraged here as they are anywhere, and then more outraged that they hadn't heard about it. I think the news media also has a lot to do with it, in that there was only one station reporting on it for a really long time, doing a really good job, which is something you don't generally see. But once people do find out about it, it's immediate. So we're also looking into different ways that we can alert folks when these things happen, because we need to be aware of how often, and both Bowser's office, the offices for safety, the police department is also used to nobody really doing anything about it, or if they do, that action tends to fade pretty quickly.
Right. So you said something like 30 departments. What did you mean when you said that? Because there's really just one NPD, right? Or are you saying that there are 30?
There's one NPD, but if you really sit and think about it, D.C. has, we have the Secret Service, we have the Park Police, we have the Housing Authority, we have Library Police, we've got police for the park rangers. All of these people have the same interactions with D.C. residents, the same authority. They all carry guns. Metro Transit has guns. Just last year, they shot someone at Potomac Avenue who also later succumbed to their injuries. So in D.C., we have all of these police departments that I think we don't necessarily think of, because in most cities, we're just talking about that city's police department. But you've got upwards of 30. You've got FBI police. You've got Federal Protective Services. All of these people are independent police departments. Mm-hmm. And so when you start looking at, when you think of Miriam Carey, who was shot by Secret Service, her 3-year anniversary is coming up on Monday, which is also the next day for our next action. And you think about, so that was
Secret Service. Where will that be? Mm-hmm. Where will that be?
So on Monday, that will also be on 3rd and M Northwest, and it starts at 7 o'clock. And it's really, really critical that as many people
come out.
Is that
AM or PM?
It's PM. It's PM in the evening, that people come out, tell someone about it, bring someone. If you can't make it, tweet about it. It's incredibly important that we shine a light on the district, especially during a time when the focus is elsewhere. There is a long history of police brutality and several murders in the district that really need our attention, our pressure, and our demand for justice. Terrence Sterling, though, is especially disturbing in the amount of information that's being obviously withheld. And I don't believe that it's the aim of MPD or Bowser's office to be transparent about that investigation. And, you know, they're not just answering basic questions. The family had a press conference, which I think did a really great job of asking really important questions about things that are obviously missing, that you should be able to hear when you hear the name Brian Traynor, who was the officer who murdered Terrence. But what about the other officer who was driving? Did he have his body camera on? Why are they not talking about whether or not his body camera was on? What happened with the car? And then and I will say, the most infuriating, and this is something that is also very, very prevalent in these cases, is that it looks like and most likely these officers called their union rep before they called an ambulance for Terrence. And this is something a fraternal order of police in every city are often being called when someone has been shot before any life-saving measures are taken. And so then for the president of the union here, I think his last name is Maul, to then have the audacity to come out and say, well, we just need to get in the habit, officers need to get in the habit of turning their cameras on. And the audacity to make that light of such an important situation, especially when we packed the courtroom last year, while Mayor Bowser was asking for all of these millions of dollars for these cameras, and now we're finding out they're not using them. 2 weeks before Terrence was shot, there was also Mr. Jeffers, who was shot by a police officer who also didn't have his body camera on. So then you ask yourself, how many times do they not have them off? And why is it during the most serious interactions that they don't?
Right. I think I also saw, it's probably the one TV a station or channel that's been covering it, there was a witness who said that the police cars seemed to block off Terrence Sterling's motorcycle. And so it's not that he hit their car, but they kind of blocked him, and he had no choice but to basically run into their car because they kind of cut him off. So just the whole situation is very questionable. Now, one last question, because one thing that seems to happen in these cases is that there's an investigation, in quotes, that's started, and supposedly there's maybe perhaps a grand jury, but then it goes on forever. You know, I've been talking to Miss Beverly Smith about her son, Alonzo Smith. And I think that she passed the one-year anniversary of his death. It's coming up. So it's very close. And so why would a parent or any loved one have to wait either almost a year or almost a total year before they get findings from a grand jury? It's almost like, you know, let's just let it stretch out and hope that people forget about it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the irony of that statement is that today Mayor Bowser passed committed $1.2 million to expedite processing at the Attorney General's office for violent offenders, yet it's taking years for families to even get these cases in court. And that tells you a lot about where the district's priorities are around its residents and holding its officers and officials accountable. And so I work a lot with Beverly and some of the other mothers upholding their stories and stories like Raphael Briscoe. And it's amazing to me the amount of just disregard, both in the way that they're treated. This is the first time I've ever seen Mayor Bowser call a family and apologize. They lied to Beverly and released the tapes of Alonzo's death before they came to her house to tell her, to show her, but announced that they had shown her first. And just the blatant disrespect of these families is just outrageous, because it's just further trauma. It's further, you know, it's a different kind of violence, and it's state sanctioned, because this is the state who's perpetuating this treatment of the families.
Okay, I've been speaking to April Goggins, core organizer for Black Lives Matter DC. And tell folks again when your next action is this Monday, right, 7 p.m., and tell them where.
Right. The next action, our protest for justice for Terrence Sterling, will be held at 3rd Street and M Street in Northwest at 7 o'clock p.m. on Monday, which is October 3rd.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this morning, and we hope to see you out there.
Thank you.
I met my brother the other day. I gave him my right hand, and just as soon as ever my back was turned, he scandalized my name. Now, do you call that a brother? No, no. You call that a brother? No, no. Call that a brother? No, no. Scandalize my name. I met my sister the other day. I gave her my right hand, and just as soon as ever my back was turned, she too scandalized my name. Now do you call that a sister? No, no. You call that a sister? No, no. Call that a sister? No, no. Scandalized my name. I met my preacher the other day. I gave him my right hand, and just as soon as ever my back overturned, he too scandalized my name. Now do you call that religion? No, no. You call that religion? No, no. Call that religion, no, no, scandalize my name.
If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. And in the first half, we heard April Goggins of Black Lives Matter DC talking about the fatal police shooting of Terrence Sterling right here in the city. And in this half, we're going to turn our attention toward No War 2016. This was a series of panels and workshops sponsored by the organization World Beyond War at American University here September 23rd through the 26th. So in this half, we're going to hear activist and scholar Harvey Wasserman giving a wide-ranging talk about war, the elections, the roots of American exceptionalism, and the environment.
I do want to talk very briefly. In this country, you know, most people, we presume, of course, war is a racket. We know it's a racket. We know it's a business. All these bases are profit centers. They have nothing to do with national security whatsoever. The only security they have to do with is major CEO multi-million dollar salaries. But in American history, there is these Puritans came here in 1630. And these Puritans had a very, very specific ideology, which is absolutely psychotic. And one of the things that they believed was that they, aside from being sexually deprived by choice, which is a whole other world, they believed that they were superior to the rest of the world. And this is a part of our strain in the American psyche. And one of the reasons that we have so many bases and why we're so preoccupied with our military and with race. And the Puritans believed that the white Puritans were superior to everybody else. It wasn't just black people and Indians. They were superior to Jews and to Protestants, other Protestants, and certainly Catholics as well. And so they did. There is this word they use called city on the hill, a phrase that Reagan picked up, of course. And there was the belief that they were going to establish in Boston, and I've worn my Red Sox hat today, by the way, because I was born there. And they're doing great this year, but we won't go into that. So they believe that it was their job to purify the world. And this is a major strain in our American psyche. This belief that the United States or America before then, the Puritans who came here, are spiritually superior. They're anointed by God to cleanse the earth, to conquer the earth, by the way, very dominating, and of course male-dominated, God the Father patriarchy that came here and basically to rape our mother earth. That's what a lot of American imperialism is about. It's an oversimplification to believe it's strictly economic. There is this deep psychological, spiritual, religious crusade going on within the American national makeup, that dates to the Puritans in 1630. And if anybody want to be bored to tears, come talk to me afterwards and I'll tell you about it. But it is a mistake to place the burden of empire entirely on our economic imperatives here. There is a deep spiritual imperative that has to be cleansed. And, of course, you know, as one of your fellow pagans, I can tell you that extricating this Puritan belief is a hell of a lot of fun. And, we have to deal with that part of it. So that is part of our psyche. We do have to comprehend as we move towards a world without war. It's not just the money. It is a deep-seated belief that white Protestant Americans are superior to the rest of the world and have a duty to cleanse the rest of the world. So never lose track of that. We also apparently have an election coming up. And at least I've been told that. And although I was born in Boston, I have lived in Columbus, Ohio for many, many years. And in 2004, we witnessed the theft of an election. There's absolutely no doubt that John Kerry, who absolutely did not deserve it, was nonetheless the rightful winner of the 2004 election. And so my buddy Bob Fitrakis and I have written 7 books about this. This is the 7th book. It does not contain the final chapter in which we explain how Bernie Sanders was the rightful winner of the Democratic primaries. I have a petition, by the way, to ask Deborah Wasserman Schultz to drop her middle name. So far, she hasn't replied to me yet. I'm going to ask these out. And I'm going to tell you right now that the it may depress the hell out of you, but the reality of our election system in this United States is it's completely a fake. The whole election is a charade. It's all done electronically now. And we keep being called conspiracy theorists, but in American history, especially when we talk about war, conspiracies are very, very real. The Spanish-American War, we got into the Spanish-American War because the battleship Maine, that was the excuse, was sunk in Havana Harbor, and we blamed the Spaniards. Well, they found the boat, and it was not sunk by the Spaniards. It blew up from the inside. That's conspiracy number one. Conspiracy number two. We got into World War I, presumably because those nasty Germans sank the Lusitania, which they did do. And it was a passenger ship, but the Germans claimed that it was carrying weapons of war. Woodrow Wilson denied that it was carrying weapons of war. Woodrow Wilson, by the way, is my number two least favorite president behind Richard Nixon. So Wilson denied it. The Huns were barbarians. We got into the war, World War I, which was completely a horrible thing. We should never have gotten involved into. The vast majority of the American public opposed our entry into World War I. But those barbaric Germans sank the Lusitania. We had to get retribution. They found the Lusitania. The Lusitania has been found. It was in the bottom of the Irish Sea. By God, it was totally loaded with weapons. The Germans were absolutely right. Another conspiracy theory that turned out to be true. The Gulf of Tonkin, for God's sakes. You know, everybody at the time knew that the Gulf of Tonkin was a total put-up job. But if we said that, and we did, we were charged with being conspiracy theorists. Robert S. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense or War at the time under Lyndon Johnson, has since come out and said that the Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened. It was a complete put-up job. And so Vietnam was a total lie, as we all know. And then, of course, we're still looking for those weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I think they actually are on George W. Bush's ranch, and he doesn't know it. But so there's four conspiracy theories that absolutely positively are true. Don't get me going on the JFK, Martin Luther King, and Robert F. Kennedy assassinations. But just think of two, just think of one name, Alan Dulles. Okay, so enough of that. We have studied the electoral system in the United States. It is completely rigged, the electronically as well as on the voter rolls. We call it, as you see in the book, strip and flip. They strip the voter rolls of people who are suspected of being black, or young, or Hispanic, or maybe voting Democratic. Mostly it's been the Republicans doing it, but we see it's cut both ways, especially in this primary season. And so literally millions of people have been stripped from the voter rolls. That's how George W. Bush got elected in 2000. It had absolutely nothing to do with Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader had no hand whatsoever in electing George W. Bush. What they did was they used a computer program to strip 90,000 people from the voter rolls, and an election was decided by 537 votes. In 2004, they stripped the voter rolls of more than 300,000 people in Ohio, in almost 10% of the electorate. 90% of the people they stripped off were black. And then, when that wasn't enough, between 12:20 and 2 a.m. in the morning of election night, J. Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State, with the computer guy, whose name was Michael Connell, who since mysteriously died, they flipped the vote count. John Kerry was winning with 4.2% of the vote, more than 200,000 votes at 12:20. At 2 a.m., the vote count suddenly switched, and George W. Bush won by 2.5%. It's a 6.7% switch. It's absolutely, virtually statistically impossible. This year, more than 50% of the votes will be cast on electronic voting machines. And in the states where you have a governor and a secretary of state from the same party, which is Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, and Arizona, all Republicans, they can, at midnight, make the vote count whatever the hell they want. There is absolutely no monitoring or accountability on the electronic vote count on the voting machines that are used to cast and count more than 50% of the vote in the United States. And given the nature of the Electoral College, which has put five losers into the White House, I meant that literally, not figuratively, but you can take your own conclusions. The bottom line is that in a close election, which will look like it might be, the whole election could come down to Ohio. Again, the governor of Ohio is a Republican named John Kasich, but he hates Trump, and he has a real vested interest in actually having Hillary win. There is a very complicated situation, but however it goes, whatever we want to think about our elections, we are advocating. They are simply not credible. Ask Jimmy Carter, as a matter of fact. Carter has said the American elections are not worth honoring because they are just too corrupt. And the bottom line is that we have to switch. We have an Ohio plan, which Bob and I devised, which is universal automatic voter registration upon turning 18. Precincts wherever, you know, on a basic minimum so people can easily vote. Precincts run by our college and high school students, plus people over 65 at $15 an hour. No voter registration, no voter ID required. Your signature is good enough. It's a 5-year felony. There's no history recently of people multiple voting and doing that. And finally, universal hand count of paper ballots, where you cast a ballot, it goes into a transparent box, and the votes don't move. And then we have advocated that the ballots be made of hemp, so in 2 years they can be smoked, and everybody will be... So, and that is essential, we believe, to stopping war. You know, if we're going to stop war, we're going to have a democracy. And, you know, we're all concerned about Citizens United. We don't want a corporate personhood, which is a complete joke. We got nothing to do with the 14th Amendment or any of the people who wrote it, but they swung it through. And, of course, that's one of the big prizes in this election. Hillary has actually come out against Citizens United because it was a film about her that was actually used in the Supreme Court case. But we want to get rid of Citizens United. We want, obviously, restrictions on corporate money going into our elections. But until we have an actual reliable paper ballot system, it's just not going to happen. We have to have in order to stop war, we have to have a democracy. There's just no way about it. We have our democracy, our body politic is suffering from a cancer, and the cancer is the power of the corporations. Corporations have human rights, but no human responsibilities. And you know, and that has to stop. By the way, I do want to mention Rocky here is actually this fellow Rocky Del Fuentes is actually on the ballot in about 40 states in the country, right? Or getting there. And you may want to talk to him. He's a really interesting guy, and he's actually running for president. He's actually on ballots. And he will have legal standing when we have to sue over the outcome of the elections wherever we possibly can. So remember that, please. Hand count. We will not stop war without a democracy. We will not get a democracy until we have hand counted paper ballots. They can spend all the money they want on campaigns. I'm actually not that concerned about that. But, you know, Citizens United is wrong. It's got to be dealt with. But until we get a viable hand counted paper ballot vote count, we got nothing here. We will have an empire. We will have an out of control corporatocracy. Until we really can get our votes counted. Believe me, I live in Ohio. I saw it happen, and I don't think I have to convince you what's needed. So in a world beyond war, we're going to have a world beyond computerized electronic voting machines. Germany, Ireland, Romania, and Canada all have hand-counted paper ballots. And in fact, the Irish, being the Irish, switched to electronic voting machines, and then they got rid of them. They didn't work. They didn't want them anymore. So they're back to having hand-counted paper ballots. So there you go. Let's segue from there into this little concept of economic and ecological democracy and an environment beyond war. In 1973, before all of you were born, I was living on a hippie farm in Massachusetts, and we had come out of the anti-war movement, and we were still very active in the movement against the war in Vietnam. But on one glorious day in December in 1973, the local utility company came in and announced they were going to build a nuclear power plant 4 miles from our house. We were all thrilled, you know. We were getting a little bored already. You know, broccoli only grows so fast, and what can I tell you? And I was, by the way, an expert on nuclear power because I had done a report on it in 9th grade. So I knew everything about nuclear power. And we never actually had a meeting. We just all assumed that we were going to not allow this nuke to be built and we were going to kick their butts and get them out of town. And by God, we did. They never came in with a bulldozer into Montague, Massachusetts. The place they were going to build the nuclear power plant is now a nature conservancy. It was totally preserved. You can go there and lie down and drop acid or whatever you want to do. This phrase, no nukes, came out of our movement. One of the great advertising slogans in history, certainly very effective. I've been working on nuclear power ever since, 43 years. And, you know, I'll probably take another 43. So on 126, we can get together again and, you know, talk about our 100. I don't know if I did the math right. But the bottom line is that at the time, when they came in there, we laid out all these objections. And, of course, the nuclear power industry is an offshoot of the nuclear weapons industry. Nuclear power plants are basically a happy face on the nuclear weapons industry. It was devised by the Atomic Energy Commission. It was kind of like a branch business, and it also gave the guys, the men and women who devised the atomic bomb, sort of a conscious absolving thing. It said, okay, well, we destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but maybe we can generate cheap electricity. And of course, they came in and they said nuclear power is going to be too cheap to meter, and that the waste wouldn't be a problem, and that the reactors couldn't explode. And this was a big deal, by the way. When we first started, we, of course, said, well, we don't want these reactors to blow up. And the industry came down on us with a ton of bricks, and they said, it is physically impossible for a nuclear reactor to explode. I mean, I heard this 1,000 times. We in the movement had to go and talk to people who were out speaking and say, don't say a nuclear reactor can explode, because they can't. But they could, as it turned out. We barely missed at Three Mile Island. We were really close at Three Mile Island. I'll tell you a quick story because it reflects on activism. Three Mile Island Unit 2, both of them are, and one is finally closing, are in the flight path of the Harrisburg Airport. If you ever fly into Harrisburg, you fly right over the damn thing. And there was one woman in Harrisburg, in central Pennsylvania, who said, you can't build these reactors, you can't build Unit 2 without an enhanced containment. And by God, she won. She just did, that was her thing, and that's all she did for years, demand a stronger containment at TMI Unit 2. And she got it, and TMI Unit 2 was probably the most powerful, strongest containment of all the reactors built in the United States. And by God, in 1979, on March 28th, when that thing melted, there was tremendous pressure inside the reactor. We still don't know why it didn't explode. There was a small hydrogen explosion. It could have been a bigger explosion. But it is possible that the TMI explosion was contained because of that stronger containment dome. Not because the plane flew into it, but because this woman made them do a stronger containment. And, you know, to this day, it is entirely possible. Well, Arne Gunderson, who's one of our nuclear engineer, thinks that there was a breach of containment at TMI. But it did not blow, thank God. And it may have been because this woman fought because of the airplane. So never give up on anything. I mean, it's really an important deal. So then, of course, Chernobyl exploded, and all the Americans said, oh, well, that's a Soviet reactor. That can't come here. The four reactors that blew up, by God, they blew up at Fukushima, are American reactors. Those are General Electric reactors. They were designed, and the construction was partly supervised by General Electric. And we have 24 in the United States that are exact replicas of Fukushima. And then many more that are the BWR model that could blow like Fukushima. So now we are, at the time that we started, we were asked repeatedly, if you don't get the energy from nuclear power, where are you going to get it? And we said, solar, wind. We had no idea what we were talking about, but it sounded good. And they had actually devised the first photovoltaic cell. We've known about photovoltaic, the chemical reaction that's the basis of photovoltaic cells since the 1830s. But in 1954, the Bell Labs devised a photovoltaic cell, which I've actually held in my hand, and it still generates electricity. They send it around to conferences. And then the second photovoltaic cell, anybody know where it went? It went up in space on the Voyager. That's what it was devised for. It's devised for the solar satellites. And it's still working. But many of the ones that they put up there are still working, let's put it that way. And so there was a nascent solar energy industry in the United States, starting at the Bell Labs in 1953 and 54. And then, of course, when windmills were around, there was a guy at UMass named William Hieronymus, and he had a design. And everybody laughed at him. It was kind of like the Gyro Gyrus of the nuke industry, of the renewable energy industry. And he had this model of a 5-megawatt, which is really big, windmill that would be offshore and would be anchored by chains to the bottom of the ocean, not directly by posts. And people laughed at him. This was back in the 70s. And we had a conference at UMass in 76 or 5 called the Toward Tomorrow Fair, where this was all unveiled. And this guy named Amory Lovins. Anybody know Amory Lovins? So Amory Lovins was there, and we posited what I now call a solartopian vision. We posited the idea that the entire world could be powered. Our entire industrial, post-industrial economy and civilization could get 100% of its energy from renewables. that will be solar photovoltaic cells, windmills, recycling of waste and methane from dumps and biofuels and tidal energy and ocean wave energy, all those things we threw into the mix. And so that should be enough to power the entire Earth. And, of course, we were viewed pretty much as conspiracy theorists, saying this was not possible, it would never happen. But we didn't know it at the time, although we suspected at the time, actually, that we were birthing a multi-trillion dollar industry. The biggest industry in the history of the world will be photovoltaic cells. I'm telling you right now. You know that scene in The Graduate where the guy comes up to Dustin Hoffman and he says, plastics. Okay, so photovoltaics. I mean, that is really what's going to happen on this Earth. And I am actually, this is a sentence I never thought I'd say, but I am moving to Los Angeles because I think that Los Angeles, it could be the first, will be the first megalopolis on this planet to be operated by solar energy. There is, as we know, plenty of sun in L.A. And one of the things is when you fly into L.A. or Burbank, where I now live or will live, I have two grandsons there. So there you go. That explains everything. Right? Two of my 10 grandchildren live in L.A., and I'm not going to miss them growing up. So when you fly into L.A., you see tens of square miles of rooftops. But not only do you see these rooftops, they're flat. Because in the east, you know, the rooftops, you got to deal with snow. There hasn't been snow in a long time in L.A. It could happen, but, you know, I didn't bring my skis to L.A. So we will cover those rooftops with photovoltaic cells. And not only that, it will be extremely profitable. The smart money, it's hard to say this at a peace conference or a left conference. You rarely have had the opportunity to say this, but the smart money is where we want to go. You know, green power is hugely profitable. There are 209,000 people in the United States today working in the solar industry. There are 90,000 in wind, way more than coal, way more than nuclear. Now, the nuke war that we're worried about now, I think we have effectively stopped the idea that new nuclear reactors will be built. They are completely priced out. Renewable energy has just plummeted in cost, largely because of the Germans. You know, Germany, this is a great moment in our activist history. The German Greens won a mandate many years ago that Germany should go 100% green, but the industrial complex resisted. And then Angela Merkel came in, and she center right, and she just completely dragged her feet. And the Greens called a huge demonstration against nuclear power and for this Energiewende, this conversion to 100% renewables. And in between the time they called the demonstration and the time the demonstration was going to happen, Fukushima happened. And Angela Merkel, who is a chemist, said, okay, now we don't know if it was partly political, partly probably, you know, she's a smart woman. And she said, okay, we're going to go with this. And the Germans have gone with this 100% conversion to renewable energy. And it is happening. Of course, you know, Germany is just small hippie outpost. It's only the fourth largest economy in the world. So when we get to 3, 2, and 1, we'll know. But the Chinese, by the way, are making a decision. Chinese are in the midst of deciding whether they're going to go 100% renewable or not. They are building nuclear plants, which is a catastrophe, but they're also building photovoltaics. Originally, they jumped into photovoltaics with the idea of crashing the world market and then taking over the world photovoltaic industry. They almost did it, but they didn't quite wipe everybody else out. And so they wound up with a huge surplus of photovoltaic cells, and they're actually putting them on their own industries. Imagine that. And so there is kind of like a test period going on politically and economically and in terms of policy as to whether they're going to continue building nukes. But they are definitely moving ahead with renewables, with solar, and they are actually trying to close their coal plants. What we call coal, oil, nukes, and gas, King Kong. We are, you know, it's King Kong versus Solartopia here. China really holds the balance. We have stopped. There are four reactors under construction in the U.S., two in Georgia and two in South Carolina. And then there's one in Finland and another one in France, and they are all catastrophes. And Wall Street is actually our ally on this. Nobody on Wall Street wants to invest in new nukes. The whole future of nukes turns on how much money they can gouge out of Congress, and that's diminishing because photovoltaics have come on so rapidly. And it is a huge deal, and it's very much about war because nuclear power is a war on the economy. And if we are concerned, as Ira and so beautifully and others have talked about, we're concerned about nuclear weapons. Nuclear power plants are pre-deployed nuclear weapons of mass destruction. We have now seen that they can, by God, explode. And there is actually more radiation inherent in the nuclear core of an old reactor than there are in most nuclear weapons. The amount of radiation that was released, cesium-137 in particular, the amounts of radiation released at Fukushima are way beyond what was released at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The only good thing about Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that those bombs didn't hit the ground. They exploded in the air. If they had hit on the ground, the fallout would have been way, way worse. Many millions of people would have died if those bombs had hit the ground at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Just one of the facts. They were in the air, so they didn't rise up so much contamination, but the contamination at Fukushima in those four reactors and at Chernobyl is incalculable. And we have 100 reactors deployed in this country. They are sitting ducks for terrorists. You don't have to crack the core. You don't have to crack the containment at a nuclear reactor to cause a major catastrophic release of radiation. It is a nightmare. I won't go into it, but the physics are very simple. And destroying a nuclear reactor, turning it into a nuclear weapon, a piece of cake. I'm sorry, but we are astonishingly lucky that it hasn't happened yet. And all these reactors now, they're amortized. The public has paid for them many times over, and they're still not economic. We have the resources, we have the money, we have the technology. We can end the war on the environment, at least in the energy sector. Then we can convert to organic food and naturally grown hemp and all the other great stuff. We can do that. But as Gar and Barbara talked about yesterday, this community building activity that we need to do, the renewable conversion is perfectly suited for that. That's, if there is a God, she put renewables in our hands at this point in time to convert our economy and our world to economic democracy. Because you can go in now to a community, this has been going on for 30, 40 years. You can go in, and I'd love to do it in South Central LA, where there are blocks of homes that are close together with plenty of sunlight, but you can go all over the country, all over the world, and get communities to convert a tether to renewables. And it makes economic sense. There is short-term profit in it. There are zillions of jobs. That's where we need to go. And with that, we will remove from the war equation one of the major reasons for all these wars, which is our wars over energy. And maybe we can take down nuclear weapons as we take down the nuclear power plants as well. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you, David, for having me.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. You've been listening to Harvey Wasserman speaking at the No World 2016 conference, a series of panels and workshops sponsored September 23rd through the 26th, 2016, by the organization World Beyond War at American University. I'm Esther Avarim, and I thank you for listening. You can reach this show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows, including our past shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Special thanks to our engineer, Mike Nocella. Raise your voice out there. Peace.